Let's read. All right. Press dispatches having been sent for political purposes from Salt Lake City, which have been widely published to the effect that the Utah Commission, in their recent report to the Secretary of the Interior, alleged that plural marriage is still being solemnized and that 40 or more such marriages have been contracted in Utah since last June or during the past year. Also, that in public discourses, the leaders of the church have taught, encouraged, and urged the continuation of the practice of polygamy. So he's saying here that they're saying that we're still doing it and that we're still preaching it in conference. I, therefore, as president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, do hereby in the most solemn manner declare that these charges are false. He's wrong on both points. You can find conference talks where they when Rutger Claussen got out of prison, he went on and on about how great polygamy is, and he himself had solemnized 20 plus marriages according to Quinn. So he's lying straight out. He's lying. And he knew he was lying.
Yeah, and I think the next line is real fishy to me, where he says, "We are not teaching polygamy or plural marriage, nor permitting any person to enter into its practice." That strikes me as odd.
Maybe he was saying that with intention of from here on out.
No, because he's saying that. I mean, he's saying right from the start, Tom, I'm responding to these allegations that during this time period, which he doesn't even specify, but he says during this time period in these recent reports that he hasn't really referred to, that there have been 40-some solemnizations. And I'm telling you there hasn't been, to whom it may concern.
Yeah, let's read the next sentence. I deny that either 40 or any other number of plural marriages have during that period been solemnized in our temples or any other place in the territory.
And that's where I think he gives himself an out, though.
Yeah, but he himself – he said in another instance that he had – the endowment house torn down in 1889 to stop the practice. So if he had to tear it down in 1889 to stop it, how can he say it wasn't going on?
Well, if it says in the territory, if there were things that were happening in Mexico or in Canada that were outside of the territory, he's given himself a little out here.
He is, but he knows that that's a false statement. He knows that polygamy was still going on in the territory.
We don't
know
because
he did it. He solemnized marriages.
Well, yeah, okay, yeah, I know, but at this moment when he's writing this, maybe his intentions were, okay, that's enough. I'm really seriously going to stop this, and I'm going to put the church at a stop. Maybe he really meant that.
Yeah,
Obviously,
he kind of changed his mind or made some exceptions, but.
So at this point, Tom, how are you feeling about the revelation part?
I'm not feeling very good about it.
Okay. All right.
I'm sorry, Tom.
Next paragraph. And this is what I was talking about, the endowment house. One case has been reported in which the parties alleged that the marriage was performed in the endowment house in Salt Lake City in the spring of 1889. But I've not been able to learn who performed the ceremony. Whatever was done in this matter was without my knowledge. In consequence of the alleged occurrence, the endowment house was, by my instruction, taken down without delay. Okay.
Better to be safe than sorry.
Well, and the ceiling was performed by Franklin D. Richards, wasn't it?
Yeah, and you know, George Cuchanan has in his journal like something, and I didn't write down the quote, but you know, I just heard from Wilfred Woodruff that we haven't been doing this for a year or two, and this is news to me. Right. You know, so the word hadn't got out that you weren't supposed to be, you know, marrying. Well, and this goes to the worst thing about this whole period is. It created this culture of dishonesty among the Mormons that took,
culty culture.
It took probably a couple decades to root out. Now, I don't think that necessarily is around today, except maybe on the top leadership. But, you know, it was there. Everybody was lying all the time. You can get the court transcripts from, you know, things like they would say, I don't have a wife among the living because she was out standing in a graveyard. You know, and they would play word games like that sort of thing. And it was just it was a whole lot of lying for the Lord going on.
Fair enough.
All right. Inasmuch as laws have been enacted by Congress forbidding plural marriages, which laws have been pronounced constitutional by the court of last resort, I hereby declare my intention to submit to those laws and to use my influence with the members of the church over which I preside to have them do likewise. Man, that is mamby-pamby. He's going to use his he's going to submit and use his influence. You know, where's the, you know, the Brigham Young, the Lion of the Lord. You know, it is my word is scripture. All members should cease doing this.
Hey, but that's why I don't have a problem, John, with the to whom it may concern. It's consistent with the tone of this. It's a mamby-pamby letter, so why not have a mamby-pamby to whom it may concern at the beginning of it?
Of course.
And
it is.
And what if Woodruff just wasn't that kind of a hard-nosed guy like Brigham Young was? I mean, what if he was just more of a can't we just all get along, guys? I mean, what if he was one of those guys instead of a, no, I'm slamming the hammer down. This is enough. I don't know. Mamby-pamby's not bad.
There would have been a lot more happy people going through Cedar City.
Ooh.
No, I won't bring that up, Tom.
Why do you do that, Glenn?
I don't know.
take the dig while you can, right?
Oh, great.
I didn't catch this first time I read it. I declare my intention. I mean, that's the definition of mammy pammy.
Yeah, I do hereby declare my intention to use my influence.
hear ye what I'm saying.
Stop with all that.
Well, and John Taylor, you know, night and day difference, you know, no, never, no.
Right.
No,
right.
Never, no versus, you know, whatever.
Exactly. All right, last paragraph. There is nothing in my teachings to the church or in those of my associates during the time specified which can be reasonably construed to inculcate, or encourage polygamy. You're the language police around here, Glenn. Inculcate or encourage polygamy. And when any elder of the church has used language which appeared to convey any such teaching, he has been promptly reproved. And I now publicly declare that my advice to the Latter-day Saints is to refrain from contracting any marriage forbidden by the law of the land. Ooh.
He's given advice.
Publicly declare that it's advice. Stop.
Sinclair's asking if there's a nitrous tank flowing in the studio, and I think we should point out that we're not all in the same place, but yes, there is a nitrous tank flowing.
Some of this stuff is just so silly when you actually read it in the light of day.
I wonder how many believing members are still listening at this point.
All of them.
Right here.
That's funny. All right, so that was sent out September 24th, according.
And then, we've got Wilford Woodruff, or no, we've got Lorenzo Snow giving his sustaining.
Let's move forward. So according to Van Wagenen, and I'm quoting from Polygamia History, Mormon Polygamia History, the book. The brethren came in that. Wilfred had only vetted this with like four of the members of the Quorum of the Twelve. So the majority of the Quorum of the Twelve was not aware of this. And he had sort of blindsided him, and he knew that once they put it out, they couldn't get the genie back in the bottle. So they came in and they had a vote on it and some, debate. And, you know, the 1891 thing came in and sort of said, oh, well, you know, Jesus is coming anyway. And then conference was 2 weeks later. And so, what happened is President Lorenzo Snow got up in conference and read the letter, and then he said, I move that recognizing Wilfred Woodruff as the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the only man on the earth at the present time who holds the keys of the sealing ordinance, we consider him fully authorized by virtue of position to issue the manifesto. Oh, there's where manifesto
goes. There we
go. To issue the manifesto, which has been read in our hearing and which is dated September 24th, 1890, and that as church in general conference assembly, we accept his declaration concerning plural marriages as authoritative and binding. Now, what it says here is the vote to sustain the foregoing motion was unanimous. We'll come to that in a second. But so what exactly did they accept to be authoritative and binding? That he gives his advice to come to, I mean, what part of that statement is binding? They're not binding themselves to anything.
It's the implied message that no more, right?
Yeah, No,
you were at it right. Yeah.
This is why
would you be more happy if you just said, okay, no more, and instead of this kind of flowery, mamby-pamby language?
You got to think of the audience, right? The audience and who he's sending the declaration to. I mean, it's not so much to the membership of the church as it is to, you know, Washington. So, you know, anyone that isn't familiar with the culture living at that time, I mean, how could you look at that and not say, okay, well, you know, they are, you know, put an end to polygamy.
But they didn't.
Well, right. But I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Well, officially.
No, this didn't put it in polygamy at all.
Not for the even.
No, I'm not saying that it ended polygamy, but in a written form, yeah.
So if I understand this right, this is something that Wilford Woodruff wrote, sent to Washington. Then in the general conference, it was read. The membership there raised their hand and sustained it, and then it got published and distributed among the church. And what was sustained was the fact that he had actually done that, and that this was the message that was sent to Washington. And so they said, okay, yeah, this is going to be our public position.
So
this is what we're going to be saying that we're doing, and recognizing that, yes, we'll render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, but we still know what's important.
Yeah, let's go back a little bit. So Snow reads it in conference, and according to the accounts of the time, there is a big silence that goes over the tabernacle. And then one guy out somewhere says, "Read it again!" And wow. So they read it one more time. And it wasn't the practice at the time to raise your hand. They would say, "I." And so they say, you know, "All in favor." And the accounts say that there was a very lackluster, sort of quietish "I." And according to Quinn and others, there were several members of the 12 who didn't vote for it in conference.
Well, because they probably were steep neck deep into it already. And they knew the consequences if you had 6, 8, 12 wives, you can't exactly say no to that because you're saying no to your family, you
and
know?
This was the big debate, Tom. I'm glad you brought that up. And it went around in Washington and everything. It's like, what do you do with the wives you already have? And this became the centerpiece of the Reed-Smoot hearings in 1904, as to, you know, that they were still fathering children a long time after. And, you know, what does it mean to quit practicing polygamy? I think the membership of the church was just taken aback. They weren't expecting this. And you got to look at the Taylor rhetoric from just not that long before, and Clausen and Cannon and editorials in the Deseret News. You know, it was full steam ahead with this. And I think most of the membership was blindsided by this, as was the 12. And
yes.
It would have been completely demoralizing. And there are multiple accounts. You know, some of the women who were in it, who liked it, you know, the first wives, they were like, oh no. And others were like, oh, great day, you know.
Well, and not just that, but there was probably a lot of local leadership that were trying to calm the waves and telling some of their membership, like, listen, you know, the church is just doing this because of the federal government's pressure. You know, you guys just keep doing what you're doing. I mean, there's obvious evidence that that was the case, because there were so many arrests, there's so much polygamy after the manifesto, that there had to have been that kind of behavior and that kind of speech, because that's the only way to explain it, because this was a very divisive thing. I mean, you were splitting families, for crying out loud. Yeah, they're messy families, but they're still families.
But I agree with everything you're saying, Tom. But the church claims to be the president of the church claims to be the God's spokesman on the earth. And if there's anybody out there who can deal with difficult problems, it's God, right? When Joseph Smith didn't want to practice polygamy, God sent a flaming angel sword to cut off his nuts, right? I mean, God doesn't screw around. So why couldn't God tell them how to disentangle themselves from polygamy? Why did he just, in this sort of, it ended with a thud?
What if God was and they just weren't listening, though, John? Obviously, I mean, there was a lot of conflicting messages with the leadership at that time. I mean, that's the only way you can explain the amount of division there. I mean, well, there was apostles that got disciplined, and I think some of them even got arrested. Am I right?
Yeah. There, even at the time of this, a third of the apostles understood it to only apply to America. You know, a couple of them, or at least one that I'm aware of, was a millennialist. You know, there's very little support for it from the apostles even. I mean, you've got Lorenzo Snow, who was in Woodruff's corner, and Richards and those guys. But really, I mean, they're even among the 12. So you're talking, you know, 2 degrees removed from God. You know, they can't, there's wild variations of what the manifesto means.
Yeah.
And when you look at that language that we just read, it was all about solemnizing new marriages going forward. And even some of these Edmunds Act and the Edmund Tucker's Act had been challenged on ex post facto. You know, is this something that you can punish people that have already entered into these marriages before these laws were enacted, or only since these laws were enacted? So it was, you know, it's a messy thing. How do you handle people that have already been married?
Well, maybe it's an appropriate time to point out too. Quinn had mentioned that was it Woodruff that read it in conference, but
it was Snow that read it in conference.
The actual manifesto.
Uh huh.
It seems like, I mean, maybe they was referring to Woodruff, but you know, tears were flowing and it was a high emotional, you know, conflict of words and, you know, body language and just different things.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of people that were in favor of the manifesto of stopping polygamy that felt like that this was undoubtedly God's decision in the matter.
I think the fundies have something right. You know, Mormonism like died on that day. If you look at Taylor, if you look at Young, you look at the 12 from before that period, they spoke extemporaneously. They spoke as people having authority. The church was dynamic. Now, I'm not saying it was right. I'm not saying I'm a fan of polygamy, but the church has to completely, in the next 20 or 30 years, reinvent itself. And the Mormonism that emerges, you know, in the post like J. Reuben Clark and James and Talmadge era is something that's completely different. So, you know, and that you see that first era just go out with such a whimper, which is why we end up, you know, having to kick apostles out of the Quorum of the 12 just a few years down the road here.
Yeah, I don't know if I like your statement. I think the fundies have it right on this one. I don't know.
Well, you can't.
They might have one thing right, but they have a lot of things wrong too.
Well, of course. I'm not about to Colorado City or anything. I don't. But
if you want to compare messy to messy,
that they have a point that this is not the way that the revelations come about. This is not in the style of Smith or Young. This is going off on a new path. And it's a path of unsurety, you know. After this, look at the doctrine. Things stop having the same sort of authority and pronouncement, you know. It was, lo and behold, you know, God has called you to go on this, here. And, you know, that'd be in the Doctrine and Covenants, your mission call. And, you know, God had opinions on everything, you know. Don't wear your bloomers with your socks pulled up so high and that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, but that's still, those kinds of things are, anyway. Way off topic.
All right. I don't necessarily want to read all the excerpts, but we do have to give homage to probably the single most quoted non-scriptorial passage, which is the first paragraph under the excerpts from three addresses by President Wilfred Woodruff regarding the manifesto. And I do want to point out that this is sort of a backhanded acknowledgement by the scriptures that this manifesto was not taken seriously. I mean, what other passage has the, you know, them going and redefending their stuff? He obviously had to travel around. The last one is in 1893. So even 3 years later, he was still going out to conferences and defending this. But the passage at hand is, "The Lord will never permit me or any other man who stands as president of this church to lead you astray. It is not in the program. It is not in the mind of God. If I were to attempt that, the Lord would remove me out of my place. And so he will any other man who attempts to lead the children of men astray from the oracles of God and from their duties." And that was said in General Conference.
That's one of the 14 fundamentals, man. The Lord will never lead the prophet allow the prophet to lead the church astray.
Yeah, says the guy who everybody thinks is leading the church astray. I mean, this has all sort of epistemological problems, doesn't it?
Yeah, the first time I really heard this quote and paid attention to it was when we were doing the 14 fundamentals, you know, several months ago, honestly. And then when I was thumbing through DNC 132 and wanting to cross-reference that against the manifesto, and I found it in there, it just kind of blew open my world a little bit, and I went, wow, this is awesome. I love that President Benson pulled this quote from Wilford Woodruff out of Official Declaration, one of the Doctrine and Covenants, to use in his 14 Fundamentals. The irony is just so beautiful that Wilford Woodruff was using this as a way of saying, we're stopping polygamy, but don't think that that doesn't mean that I'm not your prophet.
Right.
And that now, you know, 100 years or 80 years or however many years it was later, that President Benson uses that as a completely different context as a way to say, turn off your minds. You know, all the things in the 14 Fundamentals, it was just, I loved it. Amazing.
Well, if you read the editorials and, you know, some of the journals and stuff from right after this happened, I think there's one question that the church suddenly had is, what now? And I think that question has never been answered fully, which is why we sort of fell into this pattern where it can be, like you said, misappropriated by Benson into, it doesn't matter what now. You just have to do whatever they say. And, you know, once they're dead, you have to do whatever the next guy says. And it doesn't matter if those match. It doesn't matter if they make any sense. You don't have to use the rules of logic. They don't have to have any training. It's just because the whole infrastructure of Mormonism fell apart on this September afternoon. And what they were left with was nothing but the organization at that point.
Well, I think they dug their trenches in ambiguity. And they wanted to leave a certain degree of leeway for them to be able to do what they want.
Who to do whatever they want?
The church leaders. Because if they don't take a stand, I mean, if they kind of leave it open saying, you know, I'm still the prophet, I'm not going to lead you astray, that's why this is the way things are going to be for the church from now on, you know, and then they move on. And that's why there hasn't been any hard-nosed revelations from that point.
Maybe, like I say, maybe the fundies are right. Maybe the church fell into apostasy on this day.
Maybe.
Well, I think what Woodruff was saying here was, I'm not leading the church away from plural marriage. I think that's what this is saying. I'm telling us that we're not going to be practicing it anymore because the laws of the land say that we can't, but we're not moving away from the doctrine of it.
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
Well, so why can't anybody, you know, we've had a lot of smart guys in the Quorum of the Twelve and in the 70 Cents.
Why can't, I thought you said they were dupuses.
No, I was talking about the guys who thought they could get statehood.
Oh, okay.
Why can't somebody explain, because this is such an important doctrine, what the status of this doctrine is in the church today?
Maybe God hasn't told them. Or
what makes you
them,
think
or,
that they can't?
I didn't say they can't. I said, why haven't they?
I don't know that we teach that, right?
I mean, maybe I said they can't, but
what's the Hinckley quote, right? I mean, I don't know that we teach that. I don't know. I mean, is that... Am I thinking incorrectly?
Well, I'll give Hinckley the answer. Well, we do teach that. Well, so he didn't know it. Well, I do. We do teach that. It's there. It's E-132. Look it up.
But DNC-132 has been completely recontextualized. That's not what's being taught from DNC-132 anymore.
Well, that's just because if you get the seminary manual or the Sunday school manual, they just skip over that part. It's not like they recontextualize it. They just cut it out.
No, I mean it's recontextualized. Celestial marriage and eternal marriage, temple marriage, it means something different now.
What if they're getting
eternal,
the answer?
Eternal life is not a polygamous plural life with multiple wives anymore. It's
what
something
if they
different.
What if they do want to explain it and just kind of get this out of the way? But God or the spirit within them is telling them no.
Why would God do that?
Well,
to quote,
now you're trying to get in the mind of God.
And what you actually mean is, why would a loving Heavenly Father do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Why is this thing so important that it just kind of like lets out with a fart? Well, I mean, what? it's been 120 years. Can't somebody like explain? Because there are still people. Look at like the Lafferty's, for heaven's sakes. Oh. You know, there are still people who there's the true and living church. We could probably do an inventory of the number of break-off sects and people who, you know, I've read several estimates that along the Wasatch Front, there's 50,000 polygamists living like in secret. Uh-huh. And we know from like, Ann Wild, you know, who John DeLynn interviewed, she'd gone to church for years and years until Ogden Kraut died. And then she came out of the closet. She just kept going. You probably have a polygamist in your ward. You don't even know it. You know, the pure devastation from that teaching not being repudiated is incalculable.
Yeah, but what you're trying to do is you're trying to interpret what God is thinking here. I mean, if they're believing that God is telling them to withhold that explanation, let's leave this in a state of ambiguity. We're going to leave DNC 132 in, no real explanation why, just trust me, I know what I'm doing.
But if we really
Tom, we don't have to try and guess the mind of God, because Wilford Woodruff tells us, and we've got it in Official Declaration 1 in the next part beneath this quote that we just read. And this is the revelation that Wilford Woodruff has given.
The revelation okay? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and we don't have to read it word for word, but the revelation, Wilford Woodruff says, I've been given a revelation from God, many, and this is what he wants me to ask. He wants me to ask you this in a question.
Yeah, but Glenn, that was for that time frame. John's asking about why doesn't the current prophet, right? Just explain it.
Hear me out.
All right, I'll hear you out. Go ahead.
God has shown Wilford Woodruff what will happen to the church if plural marriage continues, and that includes today. That includes the future.
Maybe. I'm following.
What do you mean maybe?
Well, we don't know if that's what God showed him.
Well, what do you think the vision is of the past?
Well, why didn't God give that?
What if the vision is something different? I don't know.
Why didn't God give Joseph Smith that vision?
Like an alternate reality on Lost?
Maybe. And maybe there was a smoke monster. Who knows?
So he says that The men will be arrested, the temples will be shut down, and all of the work that the church is doing to bring salvation to the world, all the missionary work, all of the sealings, all of the priesthood power, everything that the church has been established to do, and this is goes back to the Abrahamic covenant and all of that stuff, you remember, all of this will be for nothing. So this is the answer that the Lord has given to Wilford Woodruff through revelation, through a vision. And Wilford Woodruff is saying right here in Official Declaration 1, this is what the Lord wants me to ask you, saints. Consider what's more important, that we continue to live this or that we give this up because the laws of the land will no longer let us do this out in the open and we have everybody arrested and all this stuff taken away. And so if you ask the question, why today aren't people teaching that this is still part of our doctrine and part of our culture, it's because of this, because it's illegal. We can't come out and openly teach that this is part of what we believe anymore, because it will destroy us, because that's what God has revealed to Wilford Woodruff, and it's still in our scriptures, so it's still in effect.
The God that you guys believe in is a lunatic, because first of all, if we follow Tom's line, then God is morally inscrutable. That God can do anything at any time, and we can't exercise any moral individuality or any moral agency against the church, because he could tell Nephi to chop off Laban's head. He could tell men to start marrying men. He could tell us all to start wearing chickens on our head, and we can't
could,
say.
But I'm saying
we
what,
can't
what
say
is
boo.
Here in Official Declaration 1, John. I'm not giving hypothetical what ifs.
Well, and then
I'm saying this is what's here.
Then to take what you're saying is that,
and I'm not saying what I believe.
No, I'm saying
what's here.
I understand, okay. but so God introduces polygamy to Joseph Smith, messes up his relationship with Emma. probably leads to his death, leads to all sorts of problems in Utah. You know, after they went public, baptisms just dropped way off for a long, long time. It just messed with all sorts of things, you know. And then at the end, they just kill it. This is why I mean God is inscrutable. Why didn't he just keep it to himself? What was accomplished? There's just years of devastation emotionally, family, financially. It was just a mess. You can't name one positive thing that came from polygamy.
Well, what about me and you, John?
The Osmonds. It's debatable.
The what? What did you say?
Aqueducts.
He wants to know about you and him. I mean, his offspring of polygamists. Well, and myself.
You were. I haven't seen a valid argument to suggest that the birth rate was faster through polygamy. Matter of fact, I've read some stuff that suggested it was small. If you take monogamous families, compare them to the polygamous families, monogamous families tend to have more children. So if all
But you asked if there was any good thing that came from polygamy. There's your answer.
What was the answer again?
Us.
Me.
Well, maybe you would.
Or you would. Any of the siblings or any of the children that came from polygamy. Isn't that a good
enough
answer?
I'm about to break into a My Turn on Earth song.
John's point still
good. I just want to make this one quick point. John goes off on this, the God you believe in is a lunatic. Freaking crazy, man. This is all I'm saying is if you're really trying to understand God, I mean, can't you understand that God is in a completely different realm than us? So it's nearly impossible or completely impossible for us to even understand his mind, his will. Can't you just concede that point? So if it seems like God's doing things that doesn't make sense, then yeah, okay. I think even the faithful and the believing members of the church would say, yeah, okay, yeah. So of course you can't understand what he's doing and saying and thinking because we don't know how all this plays out.
An important part of Mormon doctrine is the concept of agency and the freedom to choose. And then we can talk about things like the light of Christ and the gift of the Holy Ghost. If agency, the light of Christ, and the gift of the Holy Ghost combined together make it so that we don't have a correct moral compass, i.e. we can't tell if God is behaving morally or not, or the church is, because things that seem immoral to us, then here's my lunatic God again, because he created people in such a way that they can't tell good from evil. Right? Because God does things that seem evil to us, but we just have to say, well, that's God. He's much better and stronger and faster than the rest of us. So he knows things that we don't. But we are his creation. If we can't understand God, we were created not to be able to understand God by God himself.
There you go. Yeah.
That's what I mean by a lunatic. Why would God do that?
By a lunatic. If that was his intention to create his children to not understand him or his intentions, and especially if we're believing that God is the creator of all morality, if that's your position, then who's to say he can make exceptions or he can change the laws of morality? I mean, he is God, right? That's where you're supposed to say, yeah.
Yeah.
Read it again.
I don't know. It just, to me, this is sort of all falls apart here, you know? It's a house of cards that comes down at this point.
I'm not going to argue that this isn't messy. This whole thing is messy. I mean, if you were to ask ex-Mormons, I think, 75%, maybe 90% of them will say polygamy.
Yeah.
This has got to be, if not the number one issue, the number two issue for members of the church. It's an ugly, ugly thing. There's no way around it.
Yeah, and I think the church has a moral obligation. I was kind of hinting this before, to deal with it. I think it's for the leadership to leave it out there ambiguously, because even in if you can find, and I bet the number's high, 30 to 40%, maybe more, of the female population of the church have had serious sort of negative feelings, maybe even to the extent of depression or that sort of thing over this issue, because it's still there. It's still present and people have to deal with it emotionally. That if you count that, the carnage from this, practice and the fact that church has not ever come clear and been, exactly what the status is. And then all the sort of, like I say, dissemblage, the lying, the covering up that still goes in the manuals today. It's just such an awful thing.
But don't you agree, John, that the church is between a rock and a hard place with this? I mean, if they got rid of DNC 132, it's only going to cause a lot of damage. If they completely separate themselves from polygamy, there's going to be dire consequences. So they do have to face that. I mean, maybe that's part of the reason why they haven't actually just said enough. You know,
I don't know.
I don't know why they leave the loopholes.
Well, the church changes. The church absolutely changes. I mean, you look at this. This is an example of it. You know, to just come out and say, okay, you know, I think we all probably are sitting at this table talking, and we're saying, you know, we're talking about how complicated this is. But it also, I think we all think it's a move in the right direction, and we all think it's probably a good thing. You know, so yeah, it's, you know, 120 years ago. But, you know, that could still happen today. I mean, we could remove 132. We could say these things, and it would be the same kind of disastrous crisis, you know, that happened at this time. But it would still, you know, the church 100 years from now could just look at it and say, oh, you know, we've got our reasons.
Yeah, I just think that one of the main reasons why they haven't completely put the hammer down, I think when President Hinckley said those words, I don't know if we teach that. I don't know if I know too much about that. It seemed like to me that we're to a point where DNC 132 and polygamy itself, the church has distanced themselves so much from it. Yeah, not completely, because it's still in the temple and it's still in the scriptures, but we're trying to distance ourselves so much from it that it seems inevitable that eventually they're just going to have to cut ties with it completely, but maybe not. I don't know.
Well, I hope they do. I mean, that's why I'm a part of this, is the church needs to change a little.
Yeah.
So, Rich and John, where would you put this on your troublesome issue list? Polygamy is number one, number two. Where would you put it?
Number one for me.
Probably number two or three for me. You were saying the church is between a rock and a hard place, and you know what I would say to that is I would cut the church some slack if they had a little humility, but the brethren are constantly, insisting that they are the only spokesman for God. They are the only church with authority to speak for God, that they speak for the entire world, that we must, you know, even to get in the temple or whatever, we have to pledge our obedience to them. We have to give them our money, and we can't ask them any questions. So that makes it so I'm not going to cut them any slack, because they don't cut the rest of the world any slack. Hey, Mike, set us straight.
Hello,
Mike.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah. So where have I got it wrong, Mike?
What was the question?
To set me straight. Tell preach the word, brother. Polygamy.
What about polygamy?
So manifesto. Did it get rid of polygamy or not?
Not fully. Well, I know they later on they had to kick out.
John, are you going to introduce Mike to the listeners who don't know what you just did?
Welcome to the podcast, the one and only Mike Tannehill. Hey, Mike, no long time, no talk.
This is true. I was on double secret probation, I believe.
don't use past tense.
This is John's way of post manifesto polygamy post podcast purpose.
This is to whom it may concern. I have not put Mike Tannehill back on the podcast.
we'll see how he does.
I'll tone down the rhetoric.
Why bother? I haven't. All right, Mike. So, revelation or not, the manifesto number one here.
Yes, it was. When the brethren receive revelation, it's the same way we do through the Holy Ghost. But Brother Woodruff was shown a prophecy saying, if we don't end this, the church is going to be destroyed. So it was either leave this one law to the side, or have the whole church destroyed. So he chose to break one law so that others could continue to be a school.
Okay. You know what's interesting? Interesting about that is you say that he was shown a prophecy. Well, it's not like he needed to be shown anything. I mean, that was the times they were living in. I mean, anybody that even lived in those times knew that trouble was arising.
Yeah, the government was trying to break down their political power so they couldn't vote as a block and have their way with, you know, because they're a huge voting block. So if they ostracized them by calling polygamy one of the twin relics of barbarism, they shut them down as a political tool.
They weren't trying. So they succeeded. I mean, Woodruff's revelation that the church would be in ruins, I mean, it was 90% there. All their property had been seized. They were about to take control of the temple. I mean, it wasn't a far stretch. I think he's right.
But yeah, I mean, polygamy never left as a law. It's just set to the side, and it's one of the laws we break by not following it.
So polygamy – so to you, polygamy is the same as sort of like the United Order. It's been put aside because we're not ready for it, but it is the law of heaven, and we will someday practice it again, and we'll practice it in the celestial kingdom.
Absolutely.
The United Order, isn't it the law of consecration?
Yeah, the law of consecration.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I agree. I think Mormonism and polygamy are you can't extricate the one from the other.
Well, it's part of the Abrahamic covenant. I mean, we still practice that, but it's just a branch of it we don't follow.
What's going to happen to all the extra men in heaven?
Right. There's not enough faithful men in heaven.
They all go to hell?
Heaven's a big place. Heaven's a big place.
Hell's all full of men. Be some good mosh pits in
there's
hell.
There's different degrees. There's a lot of angelic men.
Oh, I see what you're saying. There's 3 degrees in the celestial kingdom. And the messenger.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, there's degrees. There's celestial, terrestrial, and...
Yeah, but then the celestial is broken into 3, right? And there's the ministering angels, the Ken dolls.
Right. Well, or something.
You don't make it to the top. You don't take your junk with you.
Or something. I don't know. I never heard all that stuff, but yeah.
How is it that you are the folklorist and you don't know the best of Mormon doctrines, Glenn?
I don't know what you're talking about, folklore. Why do you keep trying to pigeonhole me, John?
You never heard the no genitals in heaven? Teaching?
Just from you.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that's not something I grew up hearing about, no.
You grew up in an apostate branch of the church, I've decided.
Well, I just grew up in Arizona.
Break the tie. No genitals in the lower kingdoms?
No genitals. I'm going to go with no genitals.
Yeah, see? And Rich is our designated tiebreaker.
Oh, I'm not right. saying I don't believe you. I just – that wasn't something I remember hearing about.
Mike, genitals in the afterlife?
Yes, we have them.
Oh. You know, I remember.
Whether or not they...
Go ahead.
I was going to say there's no blood in heaven, so whether or not things work is a whole other matter.
I love the answers you come up with, Mike.
Okay.
Who would ever put those two together? All right, so enough of that. So, okay, Tom.
I just want to urge you to share this little tangent while we're on this. There was a church leader. I'm not going to say whether it was a seminary teacher or
name
not.
Name names, Tom. Name names.
Yeah, I know. He said, you know, sex is great. And for those of you that have had it, you'll know that it's awesome. That's just another motivation to make it to the highest degree because those are the only people that are going to have it. Everybody else won't get to have it. And then somebody says, well, does that mean that we're going to have our sexual reproducing organs? And he says, this is just my opinion, which he should really open with everything when he says that. But he says, yeah, I don't think so. I think everybody's going to be one and the same.
Hmm. Interesting.
So, yeah, so if just being worthy isn't enough motivation, if you want to have sex in the afterlife, let's get to it.
All right. All right, any last thoughts about manifesto number one? So let's give the brief sort of what happened next. This was 1890. There was a lot of people went to Canada, went to Mexico in the colonies. They kept doing marriages. 1904, they were trying to seat Senator Reed Smoot, and we had the Smoot hearings. It's a topic we need to go into in detail in the future because the president of the church at the time, Joseph F. Smith, got his lunch handed to him, and That the Smoot hearings are probably more of a damning thing to the church than this was. And after that, then the church really had to do some real reformation, had to get rid of the oath of vengeance out of the temple. And of course, we've mentioned a couple times, Matthias Cowley and John W. Taylor were both disfellowshipped, and John Taylor was eventually excommunicated for they kind of took the fall for post-manifesto polygamy. 1904, the second manifesto came out, and we'll dive into this maybe in a couple months here on the podcast. And then, yeah, the last practicing polygamist, Heber J. Grant, died in 1945. As far as the leadership of the church goes, so it stayed with us until then, really. And then, of course, there's a lot of serial polygamists, two or three today, you know, like Dallin Oaks, famously in his 2002 speech, declared that he was eternally married to both his first wife and his second wife. So they still practice it today, just not do it one at a time.
And not, let's just mention that the women don't get that choice.
Yeah.
They don't get to be sealed to two different men. So
there was a question asked, was Heber J. Grant a polygamist when he was the prophet? Well, he was a polygamist when he was a member of the Quorum of the Twelve as a prophet, seer, and later, but when seer and revelator, but when he served as the president of the church, I think Heber Grant only ever married two women, and I think one had passed away by that time. So by the time he was the president of the church, he was a monogamist. All right. I feel used and used up.
Yeah, I feel used and abused.
Okay, as always, the discussion continues on the website at MormonExpression.com. Go there and check out our new, just today, of course, it's Sunday the 20th. We just rolled out the brand new website. It's been completely redone to thanks to our wonderful web designer, Richard Harris. He did a wonderful job of reskinning that thing.
Yeah, looks kudos great to you, Richard, man. It's awesome.
It's really cool. So go check that out. And then we'll catch you on the down low. Mike, I'll give you the last word.
I am unprepared to say last word.
All right. There you go. Thanks, everybody.